On this episode, I'm sitting down with a distant mentor of mine. I have learned so much from him, and when he agreed to be my guest, I was honored. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Chuck DeGroat, professor, author, therapist, pastor, and spiritual director. He has more to teach us than we have time to learn. So welcome, Dr. DeGroat.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you.
I've been familiar with your writings for some time. I read your books, Toughest People to Love and Wholeheartedness. Loved them. I could do a podcast with you on each. And I began reading Leaving Egypt. Loved reading your material and learning from you in any way I can. So about a month ago, Preston Waller, our student pastor, recommended your most recent book, the book I want to dive into with you today, When Narcissism Comes to Church. I was unaware of the book until Preston mentioned it. He heard it referred to several times during the podcast, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. I'm sure you're familiar with that podcast. So he picked it up, read it, and recommended it to me. I got it, read it, in just like a few days. I mean, I just jumped in and devoured it. And I was challenged. And I was also inspired. And I wanted to go deeper into the material. So when I contacted you, and you were so generous to accept to come onto the Holy Shift podcast, I was thrilled. Now, before we dive into the content, I'd like to know, how long has this book been brewing inside you?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it had been brewing in me for about 20 years. I say that knowing that I was really reluctant to write. In fact, Mike Cosper, who does The Rise and Fall, Mike was one of those who told me, hey, this needs to be a book. You need to write this. That was about 5 years ago. But it was probably around 20 years ago or so now that I was involved in church planting. I wasn't planting myself, but I was a part of a church plant. I was experiencing what seemed to be me to be narcissism within the church. And I was also just beginning to do some assessment work among church planters and just paying attention to the kinds of people we were choosing to plant churches and what we were overlooking in people who we were asking to plant churches. And so, I mean, I would say that the very beginnings of this book go back almost 20 years, but I may owe it to Mike Cosper for prompting me to actually write it about 5 years ago or so.
Well, Chuck, it dropped at the perfect time. It's almost like it was providence or something, right in the middle of the pandemic and so many church scandals and lots of questions people have, your book came out. So I'm doing everything I can to get it into the hands of a lot of people I know, recommending it, encouraging to read it, because what is inside this book needs to be read and thought through and processed by as many church leaders and as many people attending church across our nation as possible. Before we get to a few quotes from your book, I do want to encourage those of you who are listening, find Dr. Chuck's books, purchase them, read them, recommend them to your friends, buy a copy for your friends, give it to them, and encourage them to read it. I promise you, on the other side of one of his books will be a better you. You will learn, you will be challenged, you will grow, you will understand yourself and other people better, and also God better and the gospel. So I can't recommend Dr. Chuck's books more highly. Go get them, read them. All right, let's jump into the content of your book. In your introduction, you write, and this is Dr. Chuck writing, quote, "Ministry leaders and churches today are obsessively preoccupied with their reputation, influence, success, rightness, progressiveness, relevance, platform, affirmation, and power. And research shows that narcissism is a growing phenomenon, particularly over the last 50 years." End quote. So, Dr. Chuck, my first question based on that quote is, what is going on? Why such an increase in narcissistic ministry leaders?
Yeah, I think that's complicated. I often hear that this is a very recent phenomenon, maybe 10 years, maybe 20 years, or directly related to social media. And I often say that I actually think it's baked into a kind of an American ethos. a sense of conquest or victory, a sense that we're entitled or we deserve to win. I do think that in the last, let's say the last 10 or 15 years, with the rise of social media, with platform, brand, a different kind of stage, we're seeing a new manifestation, a new iteration of it. I mean, I think the Rise and Fall podcast has done a really good job of documenting how YouTube, videos, podcasts, things like that, Twitter, Facebook, actually elevated the platforms of some of these folks who've done, I think, such immense damage in the church. But I really do think, and I, like I say, it's a much bigger conversation. I think it's baked into the American ethos, so much so that, as Christopher Lash says, we're swimming in the waters of narcissism, yeah, and we don't even know it. So it's not merely about a narcissistic personality. It's about us waking up to the waters that we're swimming in.
Yeah. So it's a product of the culture overall, American culture.
I think that that's right. I think it's a product of the culture overall. And I think to some degree, we're not, I was just in a conversation, in fact, last hour with some folks in a city who are talking about a local church plant with a couple of church planters who have done a lot of inner work and are seemingly healthy, but they're caught up in a kind of a larger system of, in order for us to be successful, we have to hit this goal, and then we've got to hit this number, and then we've got to do this, we've got to launch in this way. And these friends said, it's almost like these good friends of ours who are planting the church, we don't even recognize them anymore because they've been sucked into the vortex. And I think that that's true. It's like they're really good folks who get sucked into this vortex of bigger, better, stronger, faster. And there's really no distinction. I don't want to say no distinction, but I see this in conservatives. I see this progressives. I see this from the Methodists. I see this in the Reformed folks. I see this among evangelical and mainline. It's really all over the place.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to Preston about this at length regarding how our culture seems to produce more narcissistic leaders today. And I didn't notice that until I read it in your book, and then I began to kind of connect the dots, noticing how many conferences I've been to, and it seems as if the message from the front is the least shall be first and the first shall be last, and that we are to serve people, and it doesn't matter how large your church is, and then we turn right around and promote the ones who's growing the fastest, quadrupled their church, break all the attendance records. They're the ones who seem to get the book deals. You know, their pictures are printed everywhere. It almost seems as if our behavior contradicts our message. So I just found that interesting.
And I think you're right about that. There are some really good folks who I know who are involved in doing this work, and they're doing it, I think, in a sincere and earnest way, but caught up. Again, caught up in the system. In fact, I had I teach at a seminary now. I was a pastor for a long time. I teach at a seminary. We have what's called a Doctor of Ministry program. Mm-hmm. Pastors who've been out for a while come back and do their doctoral work looking at particular ministry issues. And I had this one pastor come to me and say, you know, I want to study shame among church planters, because what I see out there in the sea of church planters is so much shame. We all feel like failures. We're not doing enough. We're constantly comparing. And what's interesting about that is about a year into his work, he said, you know, I think what I really intended to do when I entered into this program was I intended to look at my own shame. Before I point the finger, I actually have to look at how I've gotten caught up in this and how I've been, for the last 15 years, mired in shame, because as I look around, my church never got as big as that church. No one ever noticed me. No one ever offered me the book deal. No one was ever interested in downloading my sermon series. And that's painful.
Yeah, it is. You spend a good amount of time coupling shame and a narcissistic leader. Can you speak a little bit more to how shame plays a role in so many of the narcissistic leaders?
Yeah, so I talk about the shame dynamic within narcissists. In part, what I want to do is I want to make sure that people understand that when we talk about narcissism, that word, that caricature, doesn't speak to the whole of the person. It's a label. It's a diagnosis. We use lots of different labels, addict, sinner even. You know, we use these labels to say things about one another, but it doesn't get at the core of who we are. One of the things that I've recognized, and I think many of us who do this work recognize, is that beneath the surface of anyone who might be diagnosably narcissistic is a lot of pain, and within that vortex of pain, a lot of shame. The one who bullies is often one who is bullied. And I've seen this as I've done work actually with narcissistic leaders who've at times let me in. And as they told me their stories, there's sometimes violence, there's sometimes abuse, neglect, abandonment. And there's something about that that happens at a very early age, let's say 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, that without them even knowing, this happens unconsciously, it's sort of like they develop fortress walls around them. Like, I'm never, ever going to let anyone hurt me again. They seal themselves off. They really seal their shame off. And so they live lives of invulnerability, not vulnerability, but invulnerability, with their weapons wielded for fear of threat. And that's a really lonely way to live. That's a really exhausting way to live. A lot of these folks will tell me behind the scenes, I'm just so tired, or I'm coping in ways that are really unhealthy because they're shadow boxing with their shame all the while.
So the ones who are saying how tired they are certainly do not present that image to the public.
No, and I think that that's one of the things that I think it's a real privilege to do some of what I get to do behind the scenes as a therapist and a spiritual director. A lot of what I do is these days are 5-day intensives, 3-hour sessions, over 5 days. You really get down to some deep stuff in that. And what you realize is that these guys in particular who present as put together and polished, when you get down under the surface, they're tired, they're overwhelmed, they feel beat up, they feel lonely, they feel like little boys. They're worried about what people think of them. They're terrified, and it's a real privilege. But I think what they'll say to me oftentimes is, "But when I leave this office, there's no way that I can be with others in the same way I was with you. I've got to go back to that old defended self, or else I will be overwhelmed, overcome, beat up again." And so there's trauma, really. That's a whole other conversation. But most of these folks who are narcissistic are really survivors of a profound trauma.
That's amazing. Chuck, I would imagine that the hours you have spent counseling narcissistic leaders and uncovering the things that are going on behind the scenes has caused probably a lot more compassion in you for them, because you see the truth behind the image they often portray. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, I think that there are two things I was anxious about in writing this book. One was that pastors, again, I was a pastor for a long time, but I was worried that pastors, longtime pastors, would say, "Why are you beating up on us?" But on the other side, I was worried that folks would say, "You're being way too easy on narcissists. You're trying to paint a more complicated picture." And in fact, I did have someone reach out to me and say, "Well, you just got to call evil evil, and that's it. They're just evil." I have found my way to compassion in large part because I've done this work for so long with so many folks that I know the deeper story. Now, with compassion, there's also accountability. You know, I was working with someone a few years ago who, as we started to do the work, he began to recognize the debris field of pain that he had caused. And this was really rare. He actually said to me, "I need to be held to account for what I've done. That's part of my healing." He had been working the 12 steps at the same time for alcohol addiction. And he said, you know, I need to make amends. I need to confess. I need to make amends. And so he started naming these things in denominational committees and with his elder board and in other places. And it was a real act of humility, acts of humility as he did it. But it was really remarkable. And he even went so far as to make reparations to survivors of his abuse over the years, to go back to people that he had fired. There are stories like that that give me compassion. There are also stories that make my blood boil, and especially when I see these guys who double down and triple down and quadruple down and never ever move toward humility.
Yeah, so sometimes counseling them in the privacy, you see the real person, and then you watch them walk back out, put the mask back on, go back and lead this large church, and you know what the truth is behind the scenes. Yeah, I imagine that creates some frustration too.
Yeah, it creates frustration and deep sadness, you know, because I know, yeah. I mean, I do believe that we're all image bearers and made for so much more, and that these are just overwhelming compensatory defenses that they're living out of. And what I say to them behind the scenes is there's so much more to life. I mean, it's so exhausting to live as a defended warrior in the world. Some of them will say, that's the only mask I've ever worn. That's the only mask I know. And that's the only mask I want to wear.
Yeah. I think it may be a good idea for us to pause a moment and define for our audience maybe exactly what a narcissistic leader is. I jumped into the book, and it's possible some are listening going, I'm not even really sure exactly what they're talking about. Define a little bit what a narcissistic leader, especially in the context of ministry, might look like or act like, or what maybe someone is experiencing, and it's a telltale sign.
Yeah, so like when we talk about narcissism in general, we usually look at four core components: grandiosity, bigger, better, stronger, faster, attention-seeking. Now, grandiosity, let's just go through this for a second, right? Maybe this will be helpful to your listeners. I mean, grandiosity is in a sense, I get to be on stage and I get to speak the word of the Lord. You know, I'm reverend. I'm ordained. I get to speak on behalf of God. I get to wear this robe in certain contexts, or I get to ascend into this pulpit in other contexts, or I get to lead this band of 5,000 people in another context. There's a sense of I'm larger than life, which your listeners should, as they hear that, there should be a gear grind, because that doesn't sound like Jesus in Philippians 2, you know, who being in very nature God did not consider equality with God something to be grasped or exploited, right? And so there's that sense of grandiosity. There's also attention seeking. Narcissists will go out of their way to solicit attention. And this may be subtle, maybe not so subtle. And so there's this always this sense that I need to be in the spotlight. When I'm not in the spotlight, I got to get back into the spotlight. Along with that, there's a sense of entitlement. I deserve that. I deserve the large congregation. I deserve the nice office. I mean, I can't tell you how many offices I believe narcissistic pastors I've gone into that were grand offices with expensive furniture and leather couches and books that were, it would cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to stock the shelves. And I thought, wow, this is extraordinary. This sense of entitlement, even to the extent that I've worked with guys who, for example, were alcohol addicts or pornography addicts, but felt entitled to that because they experienced so much hardship in ministry. So doesn't a guy like me deserve a little bit of that every now and then? So a sense of entitlement. And then fourth, a lack of empathy. What you'll notice is that they just really don't have the capacity to get into your shoes, to really understand how you feel, what's going on inside of you. And I actually walk through 10 different ways that this shows up in pastoral leaders that I see. that looks like leaders who demand loyalty, that looks like leaders who could be really confusing to those who work for them and even to parishioners, because on the one hand, at times they look so holy and their ministry looks so fruitful, and at other times they appear so insensitive and bullying. We could get into all of those 10, yeah. But that's a little bit of it right there.
Yeah, that was a fascinating chapter, by the way. Could spend the entire time just walking through those 10. It's amazing to me that pastors, the way you've described them, even survive in ministry. You would think people would just walk away from them. Staff would not want to work with them. But many of them continue to prosper, continue to grow. It doesn't matter how many staff they grind through. It doesn't matter how many people leave the church. More people attend. More staff want to work for them. And they continue to grow and prosper. And I'm curious what's going on there. Why would people not just throw their hands up and say, I'm done with this guy. I don't want to work for him.
Yeah. I think in part, and I in some ways I wish I would have developed this out a little bit more in the book, even in a chapter or something like that. But there's this interesting CIA profiler named Gerald Post. He's written profiles of a number of different leaders. He talks about the dynamic of collective narcissism. I talk about this too. But what he's getting at is, I do talk about this in the book, but that there's this kind of leader-follower dynamic, and that both work in kind of tandem with one another. And so there's this ideal hungry follower who looks at the narcissistic leader and experiences something, gets something from him, from being in his orbit. I feel special. I feel like I belong. I feel secure. I feel seen. I feel like I'm in a theological camp that's right. What it meets certain psychological, emotional needs in the follower. And then there's what he calls the mirror hungry leader. Narcissus, the old Greek myth, saw himself in a pool of water and became affixed to his own image, right? And in a right. sense, there's this kind of feedback loop. Like the narcissistic leader looks at his followers and he gets something from them. It's like this is a fuel he needs to keep going. And I think that there's something to say about that collective dynamic that I think I would say that people who I've worked with over the years who've stayed way too long on staff with a narcissistic leader or at a narcissistic leader's church or within a system like that will say, you know, I was like the frog in the boiling pot of water, and I didn't even know I was burning up. But it was meeting certain needs for me. I felt like I was a part of that ministry. I got to work with that guy. I was the right-hand man to that particular pastor. We were seeing these fruits happen. And I didn't even know all the while that I was experiencing trauma.
Yeah. So in some ways, the narcissistic leader is receiving something, and the people who are following him or working for him are also receiving a benefit by being with him or her.
Yeah, and it's a mutually reinforcing feedback loop of sorts.
So the narcissism within the leader is creating the people who are dependent on him or her, and they themselves can be very unhealthy, and that's why they're attached to him. Is that correct?
Yeah, they themselves are, you know, I think shame undergirds all of this in the sense that, you know, on the one hand, shame is fueling the defenses of the narcissistic leader and the sword wielding warrior who leads the church like a valiant hero. Shame, insecurity, and other kinds of psychological needs fuel the follower who's like, I feel better about myself when I'm attached to him. I feel like I finally belong to something significant. I feel like I'm finally on, you know, the feeling that you get when you follow a team and, you know, your team wins, the women's soccer team wins the World Cup or whatever it is. And it's like, yes, we won. You know, it feeds something in us. And I think, Yeah, there is this sense that people will say to me, you know, I was a part of it for 10 years and I felt like I was a part of something really special. And I had no idea that there was this debris field of massive pain in others and in me too, or that I participated in it.
Yeah. I found your section on narcissistic systems very interesting. That even though a narcissistic leader may be removed, the system remains in place, or it can remain in place. And you may hire another leader or change staff, but if you don't deal with the narcissistic system, it can still fall apart or still have problems for years to come. Is that a fair?
I think that's fair, yeah. And I think that this is actually, people are beginning to realize that this may be the bigger issue. Like we can work on producing pastors who are healthier and have higher character, but the reality is, as Christopher Lash says, we're swimming in the waters of narcissism, and so we're not aware that we're participating, even unwittingly, in these systems that prop up particular people, particular models, particular church planters, particular brands, you know, particular looks, you know, whatever it might be. It's you look around, and I do think that we're in a moment of profound reckoning, you might say, you know, where as a number of us are putting words to this, you see the popularity of this podcast, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. It's like number 3 on Apple iTunes. And, you know, you see that we're in a moment where people are beginning to take this with a deadly seriousness.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned reckoning. A few weeks ago, I interviewed Dr. Chris Green. And I asked him at the end of the podcast, you know, what are some of the changes you think will come as a result of the pandemic and, you know, many of the attendance of churches sliding downward and struggling? And he mentioned the exact same thing that you just did, that some of this is a reckoning. And I thought that was very interesting. We've created these systems and fed them for so long, and many of that is kind of falling down around us.
I think so. I think that there's a lot of dying happening. And, you know, Phyllis Tickle wrote a really interesting book about 12 years ago called The Great Emergence, where she talked about these cyclical kinds of these deaths and resurrections in the church, right? And this is what happened during the Reformation, right? There was this acknowledgement that the institutional church was corrupt at some level, not pervasively corrupt, but that there was a system of corruption. So we've got to do something in moments like this. We've got to do something drastic, right? And I do think at least part of my hope is in the reality of the dying leads to the rising, right? The death leads to resurrection. And so I think while some want to tear the whole thing down, I want to believe that, you know, in the reckoning and in the dismantling, there can be a resurrection, a kind of reconstruction, but I'm not entirely sure what that's going to look like, because we're in the season right now of the dismantling, and it's quite painful.
Yeah, it's a disconcerting feeling for local pastors watching a lot of this happen, not sure what, you know, tomorrow's going to look like. There's such a cynical attitude of so many people in our community about churches in general. They've watched the same well-known pastors, you know, fall, and some of the truth about the lifestyles they've lived come out. There's a tendency for a lot of people to think every pastor's got a skeleton in his or her closet. You know, they're all hypocrites. So it was difficult enough, and now it seems to be even more of a steep uphill battle.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I remember back in the late 90s, I don't know if you remember this, but there's an author named Mike Regale, R-E-G-E-L-E. I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name. He wrote a book called The Death of the Church. I remember picking that up. And that guy was prophetic. I mean, he was naming a lot of these dynamics that were going to unfold over what he considered the next couple of decades. And I think what we're seeing is something that, you know, something that I think I even feared back in the day when I first started doing church planning assessments, and I would be the guy that would raise the yellow flag, and the other assessors would say, "No, I think you're just being a little too harsh. You know, I think he'll be great. You know, he's got to work out his stuff." And some of those same assessors are coming back to me now saying, "What did we do? You know, what have we done? In the meantime, I think there are a lot of really faithful pastors out there who are looking around saying, I've just been doing my job over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and it's all coming tumbling down around me. What does this mean for me? So that makes it hard, too, because there are a lot of really faithful pastors and really faithful churches that didn't get into growing the brand, you know, and all this stuff. So,
yeah, that's so interesting. The section on the systems and how those systems can be created and continue on even it when the narcissistic leader leaves, I'd like for you to help us understand some of the signs of a narcissistic system. Maybe there are some people attending churches now, growing, you know, they're blowing it out the seams. They excuse a lot of things that maybe they don't feel right about on the inside. They see some signs, but they excuse it because the man's a prophet. You know, he's a great man of God. You know, we all have our problems. So they just turn a deaf ear or they close their eyes. Help us a little bit with seeing, hey, here are some signs you need to be concerned about. No matter how much you love the pastor, no matter how great of a job he does speaking or her, here are some things you need to be concerned about.
Yeah. You know, this is where, again, you sense the contradiction because, you know, the gospel calls us to humility and invites us to brokenness. And yet what you find is that within these systems that there is a preservation of power, that there's an elevation of a brand, that there's a demand for loyalty. There's a kind of insider-outsider kind of dynamic. If you're not for us, you're against us. So oftentimes a demand for loyalty within the system. I tell the story in there, actually, of a friend of mine who took a job in a large discipleship organization where he was like the third after the founder. And he said very early on, he began to realize that folks within the organization, even though the founder, the longtime charismatic leader, wasn't there anymore, the folks within the organization were saying things like, we're the only ones who do real discipleship. Our materials are the best materials. No one has done it more faithfully than we've done it. Our organization is the best organization. And he had this sense of there's something really off about this. They're using kingdom language. And yet there's this sense of it's us versus them. We've got to figure it out. They don't. We're certain. And that's what you sort of have to pay attention to. And a lot of people will say, I started to feel that in my gut. I just didn't know what to do about it, what to say about it. I wasn't sure if I could trust myself because there had been so much fruit in this church. And so I doubted myself.
So they need to really pay attention to what's going on the inside, listen to what's happening. Yeah. And pick up books like yourselves and read it and figure it out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, one of the hopes I have, I was really grateful that my book came out. Diane Langberg, Scott McKnight, Laura Berenger, Wade Mullen, there are a few others, Jim Wilder. A number of us know one another. And there was this sense of like, by the way, there's not any competition between us. I think there is this sense of we're seeing something collectively and we're naming these things. And I think the hope is that people maybe hear my book in a way that maybe they didn't hear another book or hear Diane's book in the way they didn't hear mine. And it'll trigger something. Yeah, there's something off there. I've been a part of this ministry for 5, 10 years, and I've always felt like there's something off. Pastor kind of way too secretive, or he spent inordinate amounts of money. I mean, people come to me and say, is it wrong that my pastor kind of has a slush fund, kind of an unlimited slush fund that he buys clothes and office furniture and, expensive bikes. Is that wrong? You know, there'll be things like that, that I'll actually have people write me emails and say, is that right? Is that okay? He says that, you know, he's entitled to a little bit of alcohol, but you know, I smell drink on his breath at 11 AM. Is that okay? You know, our IT technician found internet pornography on his computer, but, he said, you know, it's not really a problem, and that, you know, every now and then, you know, it's these kinds of things, yeah, and people yeah. actually have this sense of like, but he produces so much fruit, it must be me and not.
Is that what it is, Chuck, that as long as the fruit seems to be produced, people just turn their head? Or have people been conditioned to believe that they're just not spiritual enough to discern that he's the man of God, I'm just a follower? What's going on there? Why would that a person like that stay in ministry without being called out by an elder team or fellow pastors or something?
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, there are psychological needs being met, as we talked about earlier, right? And so I think that's at least a part of it, that some of those needs for belonging, for security, right, for a right. sense of power. But I think that there's probably more going on there as well. I think we often kind of align ourselves with these folks because and for some of us, this is our only way of making a living. I think that there's another piece of it where these in different vocations, people have power. You might be a politician, you might be the CEO of a corporation, but pastors have spiritual power. They are ordained by God, right? People have these vivid images of men and women on stages. With hands laid on them. And they look at that and they say, well, that must be an anointing. That must be a consecration. That must be a blessing. We have all of our different words for naming these things, right? So he must be above others. She must not be able to sin in the same ways that I sin. And I've had people tell me this, like, mm-hmm. I just figured that he was kind of allowed to do some things on the side because he is the man of God, you know? And that's really scary. That's really dangerous.
That is. Do you feel that there needs to be more of an assessment in the seminary level or in the ordination process? And if narcissism is detected, a certain level of narcissism, they should be denied ordination or moved into ministry or asked to go through therapy or counseling? Where are you with that?
Yeah, you know, I think that there are multiple levels. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution to this. I mean, I think at the seminary we're trying to do more, but frankly, there are a lot of pastors that are being elevated into positions without any leadership training or seminary training. And so, but I think seminary formation is an important part of it. I think assessments have to take psychopathology and seriously, and have to use folks like me who have some of the tools and who can engage these conversations. I mean, I have had a number of church planting assessors come back to me and say, you know, after I read your book, I remember you being the only one around the table who raised a yellow or a red flag about so-and-so, and none of us saw it. And within 3 years, within 5 years, there are all kinds of things that happened that gave us pause and sounded alarms. And so I think better assessment processes. I think that there's an educational component. I think as people are learning more, as someone like you does a podcast like this and people listen, folks are beginning to understand, oh, wow, there's something called spiritual abuse. And spiritual abuse is something that I think I may have experienced in the way he defined it. I just got asked to do some spiritual abuse training for clergy within an Anglican denomination. And the bishop told me, this is the first training in spiritual abuse that I know of that we've ever done. And so there are components like that. So seminary formation, assessment processes, ongoing training. And I think, you know, I do think that we've got to get better. You know, I experienced for a long time a setting that felt a little bit like an old boys club where the boys had each other's back and there was no accountability. And I think that when we see things, we've got to be willing to have the courage, the integrity to say, no, you can't do that. You can't get behind the wheel of a car when you're drunk, even though we just had a good time hanging out as a church staff. You can't make those misogynistic comments. You can't invite her into your hotel room when we're at the conference. You know, like these things seem kind of basic, but these are things that I hear regularly.
Yeah. Well, Chuck, I want to honor your time. I have just a couple more questions, if we could do that. One is, let's imagine that a pastor has been narcissistic, created a narcissistic system. Some things have come out. He's been removed, or he quit, moved on. How does the church, practically speaking, begin to turn that church back more toward the gospel, get it back into a healthy place? I know it's a process, but it's possible someone's listening, maybe even a pastor's listening. He's beginning to pastor a church that just had a horrible situation from the pastor before, and it looks like a daunting task in front of him. Would you speak to them and encourage them, please?
Yeah. Well, so often the aftermath is brutal, right? And people are left reeling. And so there's some healing that needs to be done. There's just some tending to the very palpable wounds that people have experienced during that time or that tenure. And I think it's wise often to bring someone in who can help facilitate that kind of care and to make possible care, spiritual direction, lay counseling, pastoral counseling, clinical therapy for people who have been particularly wounded. But then I think there's another part of the process where wise elder boards will look for folks who are able to do a bit of diagnostic work within the system to say, you know, you might have removed that toxic leader, but a lot of those dynamics can remain within the system. Mm-hmm. Now let's take a look and ask some serious questions about how those dynamics remain. I'm indebted to folks like Steve Cuss and his work on systems in the church, Jim Harrington, Tricia Taylor. I could go on, a whole host of folks who do systems work and who name these dynamics and who are really committed to the church. I mean, one thing I want to be clear about, and I think I'd say the same for some of my colleagues who've written on this, we are hopelessly devoted to the church, you know? Yeah. And we believe she's a bride, but she can also betray and be betrayed. And so commit to that work of healing. Don't expect it to happen on its own or organically. You sometimes need to bring in some folks who have a bit of expertise to say, yeah, we've got to work on this. We've got to lament that. We've got to repent of this. We need to grieve this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. Chuck, what are you working on next? Do you have a book in the works? Do you have some things we can look forward to?
Yeah, well, I have a book in the works that I'm very, very excited about. I have this tendency to think that when people hear about a subject like narcissism, they're drawn to it like, you know, we're drawn to a car accident as we're driving down the road. And this one is a much more sort of positive picture of the change process. How do we grow up into maturity as someone for me, who's been a longtime pastor, but also a clinician, understands dynamics of trauma. How do we do, I'm tentatively calling it the deep work. How do we do the deep work to grow, to heal, and to grow into maturity? And so I'm sort of unfolding 9 movements of that process within the soul of one who longs to thrive, to flourish, to heal, and to be an agent, an ambassador of shalom in the world. And so that's what I'm working on right now.
That's exciting. I can't wait for that to be finished. Any prediction of when that may be released?
You know what? I haven't even talked to publishers about it, and okay. I've just been enjoying the, you know, when you do this, there are big expectations around. You got to tweet, and you got to Instagram, you got to do all this stuff, which, by the way, feels a little narcissistic. So I'm just enjoying not having to do that right now. And maybe down the road, I'll worry about that. So
right. Well, I certainly will purchase it as soon as it comes out. You are a gift to the church, and you are a gift to pastors. And my hope is that more people will find their way to you and purchase your books and dive into them and allow so much of the truth and wisdom that you have collected over the years to just pour into their soul and bring some healing to some of the wounds that narcissistic leaders have caused, and hopefully avoid some of those horrible church crashes and abuse that goes on across our nation.
Well, that's really kind. I'm really grateful to have spent some time with you, and I appreciate your podcast too, and the folks that you bring on, the conversations that you have. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Chuck, and it's an honor to have you. And my hope is one day we'll be able to do this again, maybe over another book, and we'll expose more of your material to as many people as possible.
Sounds good.
Thank you for listening to the Holy Shift Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider letting us know. I read every comment, suggestion, or question. Also, if you like it, give us a positive review. Take care, and we'll be back soon.